is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaskans are doing some stuff that you would not believe would be possible. Certainly when I was a kid, nobody talked about running to Nome. We're all pretty impressed when Joe Reddington ran a team of dogs to Nome. Well, now people do race on foot to Nome. And people have built these amazing fat tire bikes, and they're racing those through at amazing times over the snow to McGrath and farther along. It's the Iditarod Trail Invitational, a truly amazing race for tough people who do extraordinary stuff outdoors. And that's our topic today on the show. We've got a record holder, a fat tire record holder. We've got a runner who has run to Nome twice. It's amazing. And we've got a first-time fat tire bike racer who is going to be learning maybe some tips along with us, but also has some experience on fat tire biking. So the topic today on Outdoor Explorer, the Iditarod Trail Invitational, Kevin Breitenbach is with us from Nome. He set the record on the 350-mile course to McGrath last year on a fat tire bike. Thanks for being with us, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
And Sean McTaggart is a runner who has done lots of long-distance runs and has finished the 1,000-mile race to Nome twice, which just totally blows my mind. Thanks for being with us, Sean.
Thank you.
And Lars Danner is in the studio. He actually brought his bike with him, and he is going to attack this race for the first time. And you're going to do the McGrath ride, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So since we can, I think the rest of us can identify with you as a newbie, maybe more than these other veterans, Lars. I mean, what possessed you to decide you wanted to do this? Where does the drive come from?
You know, about 10 years ago, I happened to be down in Girdwood, and there's a cycle and ski shop down there, and I saw some studded bicycle tires hanging on the wall. And I said, that's the most amazing thing. Somebody actually could ride a bicycle in the winter. And so so I gave them a try and commuted to work that winter, sold my car in the spring, and have been, you know, regularly riding year-round since then. And I have to say, the more, you know, experience I have, the more I enjoy it. It's an opportunity to, you know, get out to places that there's other ways to get out there, but there's no way to get out there and enjoy them and see the beauty in sort of the same, you know, quiet way, unless you happen to be, you know, an elite distance runner. So uh-huh. This is something that's within, you know, my capability, I hope.
You think it is. You don't actually know yet, right?
No, I don't. I don't know.
You're still smiling. But I mean, what kind of training have you done? What kind of rides have you done that make you think that the 350 is going to be like within your capabilities?
Well, I've done a number of, you know, races in the 50 to 60 mile distance, and then I've also sort of been, you know, training fairly heavily over the last, you know, several months, you know, 200 or so miles a week with long rides on the weekend. And then I think the most important thing was last winter I took a week-long winter bicycle camp, you know, where I got a fair amount of experience sleeping outside, you know, with sort of minimal gear and really trying to learn how to be out in the cold weather and have fun while you're doing it, right? Because if you're out there and you can't, you know, figure out how to be comfortable, then you know, you just can't do anything.
Mm-hmm. And that was your sort of your qualifier for the race, right? The fact that you'd completed that.
Right. That's if you pass the camp, then you can and there's enough spots, you can qualify for the race that way.
So what's your goal?
My goal is to make it to McGrath with all my fingers and toes intact within the time limit.
Mm-hmm. And what's your biggest fear?
Well, I guess my biggest fear is, you know, sort of a repeat of what happened in 2012, where there's just a lot of snow and a lot of, you know, walking. One of the things that's been challenging for me, I mean, I do have a day job, And I would have liked to have done, you know, sort of, you know, more running as part of my training, but I've really just had to focus on the bicycling. So if I have to do a lot of walking and pushing, that's going to be a challenge for me.
Well, there was one year, it's been a while now, where there was super extreme cold, and there were cold injuries and people getting lost and wandering around blind and stuff like that. I mean, that sounds a little scary too.
That's scary too, right?
Yeah. But I guess you have to choose. I asked you to choose one, so. Yeah. So, but you're looking forward to it, and you know it's going to probably hurt, but it's something you just want to say you've done. Or do you think you might?
I think my goal is to just do it this year, and we'll take stock of where we are. I'm very excited about it.
So, Kevin, your first ITI, were you sort of where Lars is right now?
I think I'm still where Lars is right now today. I think that's what's interesting about the ITI. It always presents. In some way, it always presents different challenges, but as you get ready for it, I think it always presents the same challenge. You know, everything that Lars was just saying is exactly kind of how I feel. You know, I've gotten in plenty of biking, but I haven't gotten in nearly as much running as I'd like, and it's kind of a race of, you know, to see kind of how prepared you are for it. But I think all of us end up not as prepared as we'd like.
Because you're against the elements, you're in the sort of the broad swath of Alaska, and you really don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know you've got a lot of control over what you do training, but you have no control over what the race is actually going to be like. You can hope, but you're just kind of left to do it. I think that's one thing that kind of ties a lot of winter races together is that, you know, kind of that unknown, and I get a kick out of it.
So last year you made it from Kinnick to McGrath in 2 days, 4 hours, 43 minutes. Kind of amazing. Tell me about the race. How did you manage that, and how tough was the competition?
The race was, I mean, as anyone that was up here in Alaska knew last year, especially you guys down South Central, with kind of how warm it got beforehand, we got set with amazingly rock hard conditions. So you know, no records are going to get broken in that race on a tough year for snow. So it kind of unfolded like that, and I think last year was, I think, arguably the best winter biking, you know, accumulation of talent there. There was, you know, it felt like you could have gotten fifth or sixth and still been super impressed with how fast and how hard you went. So I think kind of the race, it played out far too fast. All, like, 100% of the time, you couldn't believe how fast we were going. And you kind of, you wonder how long you can keep that up. And it's a fun challenge to see if you can hang with the other guys that are really pushing the pace and do it smartly.
What's the biking like on that trail? Because you're going through some of the really toughest part of the Iditarod Trail, right? Is it pretty challenging technically?
There certainly are parts. I think going through the Alaska Range, I think the difficulty there isn't necessarily the riding. You can slip up and make a mistake. It's odd when you're in the Alaska Range and you're realizing, oh, I'm, you know, if I jam my knee here, I'm 100 and some odd miles away from the road. And I think that's the biggest difference compared to, you know, riding that you get a chance to do on a daily basis. It's the remote nature of it, where you are hitting that technical riding, that kind of creates a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So how many times have you done the race?
I've just done it twice. I did it in 2013, which was supposed to be a historic year where the trails were amazingly hard, and they were. And then I did it last year where somehow the trails were even more historic and once in a lifetime. And,
right. I guess the way climate is changing. So you actually haven't encountered it on one of these big snow years.
No, I haven't. And I last year going in the race, I remember thinking, gosh, I hope it just dumps snow. I hope it slows this pace down. I just remember being really concerned of how fast the guys that I was racing, how fast I felt like they could push the pace. And I remember just thinking, I wouldn't mind some snow. We'll see.
So, but you've had some pretty good snow training up in Fairbanks, it sounds like, this year.
Yeah. Fairbanks always kind of offers you up a whole variety of conditions, which it really does give. I think it gives us here in Fairbanks a really good home field advantage in that sense. We get such a long season of training leading up to it, and then on top of that, I think a lot of what's intimidating about the race isn't necessarily the first 50 or 100 miles. A lot of us have kind of got those distances under our belt, but it's you start to wonder how you're going to feel 2 or 3 days into it. And fortunately for us in Fairbanks, you know, the conditions and the geography that we're left with at the end of the race is kind of our home terrain. It's the interior of Alaska, and we really that's great. I feel pretty fortunate that that's what I train on, and that's how the race ends.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about that later, about the sort of the culture of the outdoor culture in Fairbanks, which is a ongoing interest of mine on the show. These extreme Fairbanksans who like it when it's really, really, really cold and do some pretty incredible stuff. But I don't know if anybody has done anything much more amazing than my other guest today, Sean McTaggart, who is a runner and has twice finished the 1,000-mile version of the ITI all the way to Nome. So there's two choices in the race. You can go to McGrath, 350 miles. You can go to Nome, 1,000 miles, and you can race on a bike or you can race on foot. Sean has done some ultra running before, but now has sort of made this her thing. Quite an accomplishment, actually, to have done it, just to have done it. But you've done it, I mean, it's something on the order of 30 days. That seems amazingly fast.
It is. They give you 30 days to finish. Mm-hmm. So I like to cut it right down to the wire, use all my time and get my money's worth.
Right. But, I mean, you're running essentially more than a marathon every single day for a month.
Yeah. Some days, well, for me, I'm kind of the slower back of the pack. I might do, you know, once you know you're halfway into the race, I might do a 14-mile day, and I'm at a village, and I'm not going on from mm-hmm. there. So I'll rest, but then the next day will be a 30 or 40-mile day. So it later on in the race, it depends on where your stopping points are.
And you're pulling a sled this entire time.
That's correct. Yes, and it's. I think the runners tend to carry a lot more gear than the bicyclists, just because we're out there longer.
You're covering 1,000 miles, and plus, if you need to stop between villages, you really are totally out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I guess there's so many questions come to mind, but the sort of the fundamental question is, what is the mental frame of mind that gets you off the starting line, looking at 1,000 miles of running, basically 30 days of equivalent of 30 days of marathons plus. Across snow, across unknown weather, incredibly cold temperatures, unknown trail conditions. I mean, to me, the courage of starting the race seems almost off the chart. So how do you get the attitude to do that?
At the beginning, it's all nerves, and you're just so anxious to get started. but I think that you keep going because you know that there's gonna be those highs. I mean, when you're in a low, you just have to know that you're going to come out of it. You're going to, you know, the sun's going to come up and it's going to literally brighten your day and your mood. Uh-huh. There's stretches where it's really hard, you know, where it's just overcast and snowing and the snow is deep. You can't find the trail and you don't want to go on. But and just put your head down and one foot in front of the other.
Wow. So you were saying that last year there were only six finishers and only one other woman. Is that right?
I'm not sure if there were six, but that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in over six people spread over 1,000 miles is a very solitary, lonely expedition, I would think.
Yes.
Did you team up with somebody or are you just by yourself the whole time?
I did travel with my friend Carol to McGrath. We traveled on and off together. But then after that, I was alone. The mushers passed me from about McGrath to the ghost town of Cripple. But after that, I really didn't see anyone except for the like the village snow machiners who were kind of traveling between the villages. They would stop and see if I was okay. But other than that, it's pretty lonely.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was interviewing David Johnston, who's obviously an incredible runner, has done amazing distances, and it has a super positive attitude about everything all the time. And you kind of get the sense that, well, with what he's doing, I guess you'd need that. If you had a negative thought, you would sort of be stuck. But from talking to you, it sounds
incredible.
But I mean, it sounds like you're kind of fighting through some feelings of not really wanting to do this out there and continuing.
Definitely. I guess I just question, why am I out here? And everybody on the trail asks you that, why are you doing this? And I never have an answer for them.
Well, in our show last week, we were talking to some Iron Dog competitors who do, they go from South Central to Nome to Fairbanks. Their record is 36 hours and they beat themselves to pieces. And then you ask them, well, what about these runners around? And they say, I would never do that. That's crazy. I think it's the most extreme thing around, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm not signed up for this year's race, and I'm not feeling any envy for Kevin or Lars. I don't feel like I'm going to miss out at all. So,
well, but I want to find out how it feels when you get to the end. So we'll talk about that in a minute, because it must feel pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah. it's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about the Iditarod Trail Invitational, this amazing Alaskan race that goes from Kinnick, right? To either McGrath or Nome, a 350-mile or 1,000-mile race, and you get your choice of weapons, as it were, running shoes or bikes. Do they still do skis?
You may.
Yeah, but it's not real popular, I don't think. Yeah. Lots of other marathon ski races around. So we've got three guests. You were just hearing from Sean McTaggart, who has run to Nome twice, and Kevin Breitenbach, who's in Fairbanks. He is a cyclist who has made it to McGrath in record time. And Lars Danner's in the studio, and he's going to be attacking the race for the first time this year. And you brought in your bike, which is a really, it's a really impressive thing. Tell us about the equipment that you use to do the race, or that you are planning to use. You've got a fat tire bike, which I think everybody's seen now, is like a 4-inch wide tire and also studded. And then you need to carry pretty much all your outdoor gear on the bike.
Right. So, a lot of the tires are 5 inches wide nowadays. That hasn't been maybe that important the last couple years where it's been pretty hard. But on the soft stuff, really the wider the tire, the better. And so I've got sort of a full complement of outdoor gear on the bike. I've got a 20 below sleeping bag, a sleeping pad, inflatable sleeping pad, a stove, fuel, 2 days worth of food. I hope not to need that. There's about 6 checkpoints to McGrath, so I'm hopeful that I'll be able to make at least one each day and eat at those. And on top of that, I've got a change of clothes, eye protection, chemical warming pads, tools in case something goes wrong with a bike. And I think that's
Rules? Most of it. I mean, is most of this stuff designated by the race that you have to have it?
No, the ITI takes a philosophy that each racer should be responsible for themselves. There are 2 drops where you're allowed at roughly 1/3 and 2/3 on the McGrath route. There's obviously more on the Nome route where you can drop up to 10 pounds of equipment at each of the drops. And that's really just expendable. So food, batteries, fuel, that sort of thing. But in terms of the gear, you have to bring all the gear that you need with you at the start of the race.
And you just sort of need to know what you need to bring. Nobody's going to tell you.
Well, you can talk to other people.
Friends will tell you, but there's no sort of from on high, because it is like if you're going to cross Alaska on the snow. Like if you need instructions, then you probably shouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think the race directors really want people to have tested the gear and see what works, mm-hmm. what works for them. And that was the Bill and Kathy Merchant, who are the race directors, ran the summer camp I went to, or I'm sorry, the winter bike camp I went mm-hmm. to. And that was very much their philosophy, was they weren't, even at that camp, they weren't going to tell you what to bring. They were going to talk to you about the gear you had. You know, had you thought about alternatives? Had you thought about heavier gloves, lighter gloves? Had you thought about, you know, where to put your gear? And it's all just suggestions. And I think that's a good way to go, actually, because mm-hmm. it forces you to test it and see what works.
Yeah. What do you wear on your head?
You know, I'm one of those people who generates a lot of heat, and so I don't, at least in the temperatures that I see around Anchorage, I don't typically wear a hat. So I'll wear, you know, a band around to cover my ears, and then I'll wear, you know, a very thin balaclava, and that's about it on my head. It would have to get pretty cold for me to have to put on my, you know, my hat.
You don't feel like a helmet is necessary?
Well, the bits of the course I've written on are fairly straight. Mm-hmm. I did actually try a helmet, in bike camp last winter, and I was just too hot. I was overheating, almost instantly. So I won't be wearing a helmet on the race.
I find that, you know, I was just biking yesterday and the temperature was changing and I realized that I had overdressed, and I find actually biking is the hardest thing to dress for compared to skiing or running or anything else you do in the wintertime. Getting that, because you're getting hit with all this wind, and you've got this metal that's trying to transfer cold into your hands and feet, but at the same time you're producing energy. And I was also in town on ice. I feel like I got to wear a helmet because I go down pretty, you know, I go down and I don't want to smash my head open. So, I mean, maybe you can weigh in on that, Kevin, about like what do you wear on your head and how do you get the temperature right?
I usually wear a hat, just a pretty thin skull cap. And I have a jacket. I have a hooded jacket. I find a hood. I've basically been winter riding for 12 years now, and I found I've never stuck with one system. Every year I think, this is it. I've got this awesome system down. And then I realize the next year, wow, that was an awful system. It didn't do A, B, and C. I used to wear a balaclava until the last couple years, and I got a jacket with a hood, which, like you said, on a bike it can be, I would find it more difficult to dress for running personally, but with biking, you do have to strike these weird balances, and you kind of go out on the. I think the key to getting dressed properly for biking is being willing to go out on a limb on your first bit of your ride and be cold with it, because you're going to warm up. You just need to give yourself some time to warm up, and then.
I've heard that said with skiing. If you're not cold for the first 5 minutes, you're overdressed.
Exactly, it's the same thing. And what I found with a helmet, there's always thought of having a helmet. But like Lars said, a lot of that trail's really straight, and a helmet for me would just be, I have no idea how I'd regulate my temperature. And mm-hmm. I think that regulating your temperature is probably the most important part, at least when you're going constant, when you're just not stopping. Being able to regulate your temperature without stopping and do it kind of seamlessly is a really big deal. I think it's a really big deal in this race.
Yeah. So... just staying on that theme, it seems like the hands and feet are critical, and I've seen a lot of people have these, what do you call them, the gauntlet type things on your handlebars like you have, Lars?
Those are pogies.
Right. And so obviously that's a solution there. What about feet? How do you keep your feet warm and keep the sort of the metal of the bike from inching its way into your feet on a really cold day?
I'll let you know when I find out. I think I've got to, you know, there's basically two different ways that you can ride with your feet. So, you can either be, clipped into your, to your pedals, be just attached to your bike, which a lot of people choose to do. Or you can just ride on flat pedals, just regular pedals with regular boots. And I think for longer stuff, and for especially for colder things, it's a big deal for me to be wearing just regular boots on flat pedals. I find that when you have cycling boots on, when it's super cold, sure, I mean, I guess you're transferring some cold through, that cleat on the bottom of your shoe that's attached to your pedal. But I think with feet, the big things with feet for me, especially in the real cold, and lately, yesterday or day before yesterday, it was a long ride. It was 30 below the whole way. And it's a good way to test out things. But with feet, I wear a vapor barrier sock, a regular sock over that, and I size my boots up 3 or 4 sizes too big for me. And having that airspace in there, making sure that you have airspace to keep your feet warm and be able to move your toes around. Sean would know with running, I don't know how often she deals with cold feet, but I know when my feet are cold, I get off my bike and I run, and that solves a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's part of what I think it's easier, the temperature regulation, though I haven't done much running when it's way, way below zero. So, Sean, when you're running to Nome, you have the potential to run into like 30, 40 below. Mm-hmm. Do you just stop in those kinds of conditions? I remember talking to David Johnson. He said, he looks for the cold. I think that guy's crazy. But, I mean, is there a point where you say, well, this is too cold, I could be damaging my, my lungs or anything like that, or just keep going?
No, I think the coldest I've traveled in was probably 30 below. But I didn't stop because of that. Definitely I agree that you have to be able to regulate your temperature. And for me, it's probably a lot easier because I'll just start out warm and then I'll, take off the outer layer jacket. Mm-hmm. And I have my sled set up so that I can just really easily turn around, throw it under a cover on my sled and keep on moving. But there's definitely a lot of on and off with the layers. Mm-hmm. When it gets really cold, I'm just wearing normal running shoes. But for cold weather, I put on like Neo over boots, and that's really helpful for me.
And you think that's enough, just a running shoe and then an over boot?
So far, it has been.
Uh-huh. Do you take those chemical warmers and put them in there?
No, not in my feet. I think it's makes the fit too tight.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the other runners have, they'll use like a vapor barrier sock or, a sock liner and then a wool sock. But I just wear one pair of wool socks, but bring many pairs.
My sense is that those warmers don't seem to work as well in the ones that go on your feet don't seem to work as well. I don't know if they don't get enough air or something. They need more oxygen, but the ones that are sort of permeable on both sides as opposed mm-hmm. to ones that stick on your feet seem to work a lot better.
Yeah.
That's my experience.
They're good for sleeping with in your sleeping bag, sticking them to your
Yeah, they make you feel better for
mm-hmm,
sure.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin and Lars, what about goggles? I've seen people riding around town in cold weather. I personally, whatever you guys think, I think if you're riding around town, you need to wear a helmet, especially on ice. But I see them wearing goggles and just keeping their faces completely covered like a snow machine or would it. Is that what do you do that, Kevin?
I don't. I do the complete opposite. I almost never cover my unless the wind is horrendous. Wind is more of it for covering up my face. But other than that, it'll be 40 below and I'll have my face and eyes exposed. I think goggles are great when it's really windy. You just need them. There's no getting around it. But I really think that having your face covered and covering your eyes, but especially covering your face. By covering your face, you keep all that moisture right next to your mm-hmm. face. And now you're dealing with this really moist environment. And when you stop, it's frozen to you. You're dealing with water against your skin a lot, where if you got your face exposed, you're expelling all that moisture. So much of your moisture obviously comes out of your mouth. A lot of times I hear people ask, how do you keep your goggles from fogging up? And I think usually the best way to do that is to not wear them. The record to McGrath is, we average something like 6 miles an hour. It's not like this is a high speed event. And I think it's pretty hard when you're going pretty slow and you're wearing goggles to keep everything clear. So that's my experience. But I think I honestly think everyone's very different with the winter.
Yeah, and I've spending time in the Arctic, I've noticed that especially elders will wear nothing on their face, even super cold weather on a snow machine. They feel like your face is safer without being covered up, probably for the same reasons you're talking about, moisture. But most people can't do that. I mean, if I did that, my face would be black with frostbite. So I don't know. Maybe there's – I don't know how they manage that. But Lars, what's your take on the face?
I haven't had any success finding goggles that don't fog up on me pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I will use in windy conditions, I'll use the sunglasses you can see over there on my bike. And in terms of covering up the rest of my face, I do have a beard, so that helps quite a bit. And then if my nose gets cold, I'll momentarily sort of pull up my balaclava to cover my nose for 5 or 10 minutes. But I can't, like Kevin points out, I can't keep it up there for long because then the thing
you're soaked
becomes very wet. So
yeah.
That's been my approach so
right.
far.
Well, so much more to talk about. The ITI is kind of a proving ground for long-distance outdoor activity, which a lot of our listeners are interested in. And we're going to talk much more about the race and just the experience of the race of these remarkable athletes that we have on the show today. Kevin Breitenbach, who's from Fairbanks, a record holder for the 350-mile bike up to McGrath. Sean McTaggart has run to Nome twice. And Lars Danner, who's a first-time ITI biker this year. We'll be back for another half hour of this conversation. But first, we're going to take a quick break. The report you're going to hear comes to us from the finish line of the Iditarod Trail Invitational. Reporter Anna Rose MacArthur caught up with racer Phil Hofstetter just 30 minutes after he pedaled into Nome last year. A lack of snow meant last year was the first time Iditarod Trail racers finished ahead of the dog sledders.
What are you doing, Daddy?
Interview.
Oh.
This is Phil Hofstetter, third place finisher in this year's 2014 Iditarod Trail Invitational.
This year, the trail was just completely for bikers because there was hardly any pushing or any, it was just riding all the way.
So hard-packed snow, ice, and dirt, that was mainly the terrain?
Pretty much, yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, glare ice, too. You could see, like, right down to the bottom sometimes.
And what was the first year that you did this race?
2008.
I'm Anna Rose MacArthur, and I met Phil at his house in Nome last Friday, March 7th, about 30 minutes after he crossed the finish line. I actually walked in the door with his wife, Sarah, and his two young kids, Hannah and Joe. His kids raced towards him, latching onto his legs. He hugged them, then kissed Sarah. Phil's face was unshaven, his standing stiff and a little shaky, eyes tired, but he was all smiles, happy to see his family and eager to talk. Sarah placed a hot plate of chicken curry in front of him. He took one bite and was ready to do the interview.
I came in at 8 o'clock, so that would put it at 12 days and 6 hours.
That time is 5 days and 3 hours faster than when Phil won the race in 2010.
It was real hard packed. There's not much snow. You know, I've been hearing about that with the Iditarod, but it ends up being fast for biking. The ice, we had studs on the tires. I still fell over a lot, but it still made for a fast trail. You're not grinding through deep snow. You're not pushing the bike through snow. It was just almost all exclusive riding.
Every year since 2002, 50 competitors from around the world have been invited to participate in the Iditarod Trail Invitational. It's a race, stretching across Alaska. The route follows the historic Iditarod Trail. What happens is, the last week of February, a week before the Iditarod Trail sled dog race begins, competitors on bikes, skis, or foot start in Kinnick in southeast Alaska, about 50 miles north of Anchorage, and they race northwest, 350 miles to McGrath, a small community on the Kuskokwim River. The fastest recorded time for that race is 2 days, 4 hours, and 43 minutes. That record was actually set this year by cyclist Kevin Breitenbach. But Phil didn't stop in McGrath. He and 16 other competitors continued onwards to Nome.
So was there any point along the route when you thought, I can't, this isn't going to happening, I'm not going to go on, or was it always, I'm going all the way to Nome?
The race was flying by, and I had no problems at all up until crossing from Shaktulik to Koyuk. It was blowing so hard, and I got lost. There's open leads, and I left in the middle of the night, and it was blowing white out, and I lost the sticks that cross over to this place called Island Point, where there's a shelter cabin. And they ended up going inland into the mountains. And because it was so cold and windy, my eyes started getting this halo effect. And I thought it was frostbite. I thought I frostbit my eyes. So I saw the Island Point and I made a beeline for it. I think it was like a 5 mile. I ran for it as hard as I could. So I got a fire going. And I was, that was a little nervous. That was something that I did not expect. That was, I lost a bunch of time doing that, but it was also brutal, brutal, brutally cold with the wind.
Competitors are not allowed any outside assistance throughout the race. To do so would mean a scratch. No family members, friends, or pacers can meet racers along the route. Also, participants can't arrange for anyone outside the race to break trail. Furthermore, racers must carry all their own gear and clothing from beginning to end. As long as racers follow these rules, they can take any course to get from destination to destination. There is no marked trail or designated route. There are no mandatory layovers or required equipment to carry. Racers just have to sign in and out at 10 set checkpoints along the trail. And this severance from external support and absence of guidance is purposeful. The race was created for competitors to rely on their own abilities and level of experience. The participants decide what to carry, when to ride, when to rest, and what course to take. What's more, unlike the other competitors, Phil lives in Nome, so he wasn't just racing to the finish. He was racing home.
You live in Nome, and it ends in Nome, and you can bike literally just up to your front door. What's that like?
It was really strange pulling in tonight. It was just like I went for a bike ride, and I came in, and then I went to the, you know, we had the little gathering at the arch, and then I rode my bike, and it's in my garage just like I usually do. It was just really cool, and here I am.
For the first time in the race's history, the Invitational bikers arrived before the first mushers. And unlike the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, when the Iditarod Invitational competitors cross under the arch, there is no purse waiting for them. There is no compensation, no money, no prizes, and unless you have a friend or family member in Nome, there's usually no cheering crowd or really anyone for that matter at the finish. No one noticing that you just biked, walked, or skied 1,000 miles across Alaska. For KNOM Profiles, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about the Iditarod Trail Invitational. It's a human-powered race, as opposed to the Iron Dog machine-powered race or the Iditarod Trail dog-powered race. But you can use your human power with shoes on as a runner, as a biker, or on skis, although I think that's become pretty rare. And we have three guests, two bikers, Kevin Breitenbach is in Fairbanks, and he's the men's record holder, winning the 350-mile version of the race to McGrath last year, and he joins us from Fairbanks. And Lars Danner is an Anchorage biker who's going to try this for the first time this year. And Sean McTaggart is a runner who has twice completed the 1,000-mile version of the race all the way from Kinnick to Nome in the 30 days that it takes to do that, which is such an amazing accomplishment. And Sean, you were telling us that you got started. Your first ultra was the Susitna 100, which is also a really long way. And you got into that because you'd done a lot of running. You just thought you'd give it a try. And how did it feel when you did it?
The Susitna 100 was my first winter race, and I think some friends in Washington had told me about it and recommended it.
Oh, you didn't live in Alaska yet?
Yeah, no. And it was, at the time, I hated it. I was so sleep deprived, and when I got done, I just thought, I'm never doing that again. But then shortly after arriving back home, as happens, you know, after you finish a race and some time has passed, you decide, oh, that wasn't so bad. I'd like to go back and do that again. So
I started. Amnesia thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started dreaming and making plans to come back to Alaska.
Was it part of it just you get there and people say, you went to Alaska, you ran 100 miles in the snow, you're incredible, and they're so impressed with what you did. And so you start to think, yeah, I want that to be me.
Oh, maybe that is it. Yeah, that's a very good explanation. I think have these memories of, you know, you're walking, you know, over a frozen lake, and all you see, you know, as far as you can see, is just black sky and big bright stars, and it's just an amazing experience.
It's really kind of beautiful and mysterious.
Yeah, you just want to recreate that.
And from there you did the 350 version. How did that compare to doing 100? I mean, three times farther, but I mean, in terms of your preparation and the feeling of it.
It was, in some ways, for me, it's easier this race is, because it's longer, and I have planned, stops each night to sleep. And that's one of my bigger issues, is staying awake.
Rather than just going right through.
I guess I didn't prepare as much as I should have when I came up and did my first ITI. A lot of my gear was really inadequate, and like Lars said, they don't have any required gear. They probably should. Yeah. I think I had a North Face fashion jacket. It was a down jacket, but it was very inadequate, and I couldn't zip it around myself in my bladder. I brought a Jetboil stove, which is just does not work once you get below freezing.
No, you can't use that.
Yeah, there's just some real rookie mistakes. So I'm kind of, got lost my first night out there. And so, you know, everything turned out.
Did you feel like you were in danger?
I never felt like I was in danger. Was just kind of disappointed in myself at first.
So what is the checkpoint situation? Are you essentially able to, if you're sort of still functioning, make it from checkpoint to checkpoint so you never have to really sleep outside?
Yes, that's correct. I try and time all my sleep stops to coincide with the checkpoints. So at first you're in lodges, and then once you get to Roan, you're just in a canvas tent with a stove inside.
But it's warm.
So
do you sleep inside the checkpoint then?
I do, yeah. A lot of people don't like to just because it does get very hot inside and just all the commotion get crowded inside. And it's just easier for a lot of people to more efficient to sleep outside on the trail.
Seems like there's a recovery factor, though, in terms of your body's not producing all those calories, burning all those calories just to stay warm.
Yeah. But the race is a vacation to me, and part of that is that I love getting into a village and just hunkering down, you know, going to the store and buying up Cokes and pastries and microwave burgers and just hunkering down in the school and putting my feet up and enjoying myself for about 12 hours.
Is there a social aspect to that where you meet a lot of people? And
definitely. you know, at the schools especially, there it's a focal point of the villages. And so
they're probably pretty excited to see you come through.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and they like to.
What about the other racers? I mean, do are people pretty supportive or more competitive?
My experience has been that everybody's really supportive, I think every year I've traveled at least part of the way with someone. You know, it's you don't usually plan who you're going to end up traveling with, but it seems like you usually end up finding someone who makes a good travel partner, or at least someone to meet up with, you know.
Be quite a bonding situation, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to cover that kind of mileage. Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it's usually, I think, better to kind of rubber band back and forth with someone, whether, you know, instead of committing to stay with somebody on the trail, because then you're only going as fast as the slowest person, and mm-hmm, one of you is going to get cold, so...
Also, there's only so much time you want to spend with anybody, right? turning to you, Kevin, having done the bike, it only takes you a couple of days. So the checkpoint situation isn't near as important, I guess, as it is for the runners.
It's not. I guess the there's definitely a different pace to the race between the runners and the bikers. But to say the checkpoints are still certainly really, really important. For biking, the race is pretty long. It's 350 miles, but a lot of times you just do a lot of bike rides that you've done already. You do a lot of 4 and 5 hour bike rides, and checkpoints kind of break them up nicely like that. I certainly don't, you try and not spend much time in them. It's nice to have those focal points out and ahead of you. You know, it's nice to count down the miles that you think you have left, or it's nice to know that if you're soaking wet, you can hang your clothes up next to a wood stove probably and dry them off. I think they take on a different importance than they do for runners. I find with this race that every part of it's competitive, and you need to competitively rest is kind of what I started thinking a lot last year, is that I need to be the best rester that's in this checkpoint. I need to get my stuff done as fast as I can, which means I need to know what I'm going to do when I get there, and I need to know where my things are that I want. And then if I get my things done, if I get my food down, if I get my clothes dry, that means I can shut my eyes for 4 or 5 minutes, and even if I don't fall asleep, rest is rest. They take on a different feel.
So in terms of your, you know, you did the race in basically 52, 53 hours. It would be possible for you, I would think, just to go right through, right? I mean, is the race getting to that point where people might just try to do 350 miles to McGrath with minimal rest, just sort of refuel and get back on the bike? Or is there any requirement that you rest?
I think that people have been doing that even when the years that the races take 5 or 6 days. You know, I mean, the reason why Pete Basinger was able to win in 2012 was because he was just willing to keep on moving when other people stopped, and then he got to lodges along the way, and he got all the candy bars before everyone else got them. And I think that's what's kind of amazing about this race. And I think it's honest and cheesy as it sounds, it's kind of what's amazing about people. And with this race, I mean, the name lends itself to kind of comparing yourself to dogs a little bit. But it's pretty astounding to see how easy people keep on moving, you know, and not stopping. And so last year with the race, with it being that fast, maybe we slept a total of 40 minutes to an hour, a little bit more maybe, on the entire race. But last year, I think what was unique with the trails being so fast, I remember feeling like we're moving down this so quickly that I can take a little bit more time at these rest points, because sometimes when the trail's really bad, if you're moving, it doesn't matter if you're stumbling along next to being, you know, falling asleep on your bike and you're still moving 2 or 3 miles an hour, that's a lot faster than not moving at all. But last year, it felt like you really needed to be moving fast, and you needed to be able to ride hard. And I found it was I found it last year pretty important to really take my time in one respect at each checkpoint and make sure I'm ready to go out for another, you know, however long it was between each checkpoint, to really be able to attack it and kind of keep up with whoever's setting the pace.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of differences between the foot race and the bike race, obviously, and a lot of differences between 350 and 1,000. It sounds like for Sean, it's putting together a series of long days, mm-hmm. where you can just keep going, whereas for the bikers, maybe you're, at the end of 350, you want to spend everything and you're just like, you collapse, right? I mean,
Yeah, I'd agree. You try and finish on empty. Which is really exciting. I think with biking, you start to realize there's a number of different things that kind of get you, that keep you moving down the trail. It's not always just your fitness. Excitement keeps you going down the trail. Especially, you know, I've been fortunate these last 2 years to kind of push the pace up in the front. And I, compared to races that I've done in the past where I haven't been competitive, to now and doing it, you know, trying to race for first is, it's something. It's a lot of fun. I found it a lot of fun and really exciting. And I
imagine, yeah. So what is your history, Kevin? What's your background in terms of athletics?
I mean, years ago I ran in college, but not very successfully. I moved up to Alaska and, I bought a bike. I moved up to Alaska, I think, 12 years ago, and I bought my first bike, and I realized I love biking around. And then I started just traveling by bike. I did 2 trips from Alaska over to the East Coast on a bike, and just kind of thought, this is a neat way to travel. And that, I think, now I have 2 kiddos, and as time goes on, you don't find as much time in your life for just simple vacations to get away. And I think I really started racing because I needed a reason. I needed a reason to be able to do that sort of thing. I've always loved it, and I've always loved traveling. I started in 2009. I did the Susitna 100. That was my first race, just like Sean. And I was a disaster. I was a dumpster fire out there. I think it took me on a bike. I think it took me about 40 hours. I got 42nd place, and you know, it's kind of an eye opener. It's a fun challenge.
Yeah, yeah, pretty cool. So I've got a question may sound like a beginner question, but I mean, if the trails are as hard as you're talking about they were last year, and we're recording the show in January, so when we refer to now, we don't know what the weather's going to be like when the show airs, which will be right around the time of the race. But if the trail is hard and icy, would you be better off with a traditional mountain bike with studs on it rather than a fat tire bike? I mean, could you just make really good time with a traditional mountain bike, or is a fat tire bike not that much slower? What do you think?
Not anymore. I think I used to make that argument only because I didn't own a fat tire bike. I did a lot of winter races just on a regular mountain bike up until 2.5 years ago. I didn't have a fat bike. And so, I think there's sometimes in a 100-mile race you can make that argument. You can make that argument if you sit in the 100 or in the White Mountains that goes on up here in Fairbanks in March. You could make that argument for that race, too. I think you could certainly do it on a mountain bike and reduce that rolling resistance. But for something with the ITI, and really in all honesty, even with a 100-mile race, there's so many variables. And there's something to riding fast, and there's something to riding really fast, but there's something... that a fat tire bike, it gives you a lot of security. You know that you can deal with a lot of different terrain on that same bike. And it takes a lot of that anxiety out, that, oh gosh, I hope the trails, you know, I hope they hold firm. When you're on a fat bike, you stop caring about that as much. And so I think kind of that this race exhausts you in a physical way, but it can exhaust you in a mental way. And I think if I was on a regular mountain bike still, you know, just that exhaustion of trying to make up time and trails are hard compared to if it's drifted in and you're pushing, as long as, you know, if you're riding your bike, you're always going faster than someone pushing their bike. So.
Yeah, for sure. So, Lars, what was your transition to the Fat Tire bike like? I mean, was it, everybody says, oh my God, it's like the skies opened up and angels started to sing.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to Kevin and my thoughts were sort of very similar to his. I've actually only been riding a Fat Tire bike for about 2 years, and before that it was just studded tires, actually fairly thin studded tires. I will say that if you even look at something like the Frosty Bottom, people for the last several years have tried to do that on mountain bikes and haven't been successful as folks on the fat bikes.
And that's just across town on Chester Creek Trail.
Yeah, Chester Creek Trail up through the Bicentennial Park, mm-hmm. and then down the Coastal Trail. And even that race, it's about 45 miles. Even that race has enough variability that the fat tires, you know, really help you and give you confidence that you're going to be able to ride no matter what you go through. And you can nowadays, with carbon rims and carbon frames, they're very light. They're not really materially heavier than a conventional mountain bike. So you don't really give up much use in them, and you get a lot more flexibility.
What's your biggest accomplishment prior to what you're going to accomplish now?
Actually, probably I would say it's the two marathons I've run. I'm not a fast runner, but those are sort of my biggest athletic achievement. And then on top of that, last winter I did a 60-mile bike race called the Iditarod Sport, which is on the first little bit of the Iditarod Trail. So I've had a little bit of experience there. And then a few other races around town.
Uh-huh. And your training schedule is, are you getting up to a mileage that's comparable to what you're doing?
I'm riding right now about 200 miles a week. So, mm-hmm. You have 11 days actually to do the ITI. So I'm actually on pace with my training right now. And I'm doing, 80 to 90 mile rides on the weekend as well. So we'll find out in a few months if that's adequate or
and
not.
And you said you sold your car, so you get around bike only?
Bike only, yeah. Unless my wife lets me borrow the car, which she does every couple of weeks.
Uh-huh. So how's that working out for you? I mean, what are the we've just got 30 seconds left, but is it make sense for a lawyer to get around town on a bicycle?
I've been doing it for 10 years. It seems to work okay. And I ran into another lawyer on his bike going from one meeting to the next. So it is apparently possible.
Uh-huh. I would be afraid of getting killed by a 17-year-old driving a pickup truck.
That's always a risk, yeah. So you have to be very careful and assume they don't see you. Would be my one piece of advice.
Right.
Eye contact doesn't work. Just assume they don't see you. They're looking at the bird over your shoulder and let them go.
Right. Well, it's still cool that you're doing it. And congratulations just on that part of your life, let alone 350 miles on a bike. It's been a fun show. I really appreciate it. All my guests, Lars Danner, who is taking on the race this year. Kevin Breitenbach joined us from Fairbanks. He's a record holder for the 350-mile ITI, and Sean McTaggart, who's done this amazing 1,000-mile run to Nome twice. And we're coming up slowly on the Iditarod next week. Join host Annie Fite for an hour with mushing phenomenon Ali Zirkel. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Goki. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.